Hank Klibanoff is the managing editor for News at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's also the co-author, along with Gene Roberts, of a book called The Race Beat: The Press, the Civil Rights Struggle, and the Awakening of a Nation. As Klibanoff and Roberts write in the book, the nation's press ignored the civil rights struggle for decades. Hank Klibanoff told Ann Strangchamps about the first civil rights story that made a lot of headlines in the mainstream media.
The Emmett Till trial, certainly in the late summer, early fall of 1955, would not have necessarily been called a civil rights story at the time. It was just a horrific crime against a 14-year-old black kid who came down to the Delta of Mississippi from Chicago. But it certainly drew major national attention. It drew a lot of reporters from Chicago, from New York, from the wire services, from television. And it also, for the first time, lent some odd and dignity to the black reporters who were there, because the judge agreed to let them have a table inside the courtroom not far from where he sat and from where the witnesses sat. And so for the first time in a significant way, you had a cadre of white reporters from across the nation sitting in the same courtroom and basically at the same level and status as black reporters from across the nation, covering a story of this great atrocity that was racial in nature.
Now, I imagine for Southern readers, this was one more racial killing in a long history of them. But in many ways, this would have been the first for Northern newspaper readers, right?
It was certainly the most pronounced that came to their attention. The fact is that in that same year, 1955, two significant black leaders for voting rights and for human rights in the Mississippi Delta were both killed. And while, again, it got great coverage in the black press, no one else really paid much attention to it. But Emmett Till, the idea that it was a 14-year-old, I think, was just too provocative for the nation to ignore and for its press to ignore.
What happened when Till's murderers were acquitted? How was that covered in the press?
Well, no one expected otherwise. When the jury returned, as the Race Beat points out, the jurors took, I think, almost an hour to return their verdict. But what they said was it wouldn't have taken that long, except they stopped to have a soda. No one expected otherwise. It was standard fare for acquittals to come in cases like this. But what did happen in the Emmett Till case, one of the more remarkable reporters of the last century, William Bradford Huey, an Alabamian, he came into town. He was just freelancing, and he got to know the lawyers for the two men who were accused of killing Till, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant. And he drank a lot with them, and he sort of figured out that the two lawyers had no loyalty whatsoever to Milam and Bryant. They thought they were, in their own words, a bunch of peckerwoods, who rednecks, who were ultimately going to give the South a bad name if they weren't controlled. They agreed to a deal with William Bradford Huey in which he would pay money for Milam and Bryant and Carolyn Bryant, the wife of one of them, the woman who Till allegedly wolf-whistled, to tell the story of what happened and how they killed Emmett Till. And they agreed to it, and they took the money, and they told their story, and it was published. And even though there were some people initially challenged it, it ultimately has been proven right and has stood the test of time.
That's an extraordinary story. Well, what effect did Huey's story have when it was published? Were the suspects retried?
No, there was no retrying them, and it may have been pointless, too. The agreement he had prohibited him from writing specifically that they had confessed. All he could do was render this very powerful narrative of how they did it without actually saying, and this is the story they have told me. Mm-hmm. So early on, some of the segregationist editors in the South, in a particular a segregationist columnist named John Temple Graves, just accused Huey of making it all up, of lying. And Huey was kind of in a box. He didn't know how to prove otherwise. But somehow, and I think it was through an intermediary, an attorney who sort of lived in the two worlds of segregation and progressive thought, was able to prove to John Temple Graves and to other editors in the South that Huey had, in fact, interviewed these people. And Huey demanded and got from this Graves an apology, and ultimately quite a few newspapers in the South that had run the John Temple Graves column accusing Huey of being a liar had to run apologies for that.
What kind of impact do you think Huey's story had on the general media coverage of civil rights issues? I'm wondering whether, in particular, whether Huey's story partly began to convince other reporters and other editors to kind of tell the truth about the real violence that was being perpetrated against blacks in the South.
Now, that's a very good question. I think it's inevitable that that's true, that the lesson from William Bradford Huey on this and on other stories that he did, because he was a remarkable man, the lesson was that if you dig deep enough and if you keep going, there is a truth to be found. And he liked to say, I'm in the truth-telling business. And while your average daily reporter, you know, for a wire service churning out the stories doesn't necessarily have time to go back in and do the kind of work that Huey did, it certainly led people to daily reporters to understand that there is always going to be a story behind the story. And it's not that anyone doubted that Milam and Bryant did it. They only doubted whether they could ever get them to acknowledge that they did it or get a jury to believe that they did it or get a jury to convict them. And I think it probably was a great lesson for other reporters.
At what point did the mainstream press begin to kind of take the gloves off and begin reporting really openly and frankly about the kind of violence they were seeing in the streets during civil rights protests?
2 years after Emmett Till, you have this extraordinary situation that develops in Little Rock, Arkansas. Little Rock was a very progressive town. They had a progressive governor, Orville Faubus, who had been promoted and supported by the editor of the Arkansas Gazette, which itself was progressive. Arkansas, not unlike several border states abutting the South, were moving forward on integration issues. But at the last minute, segregationist forces came down on Orville Faubus. They cornered him. They made him re-examine his progressive thinking. And then on the eve of school integration at Central High School in Little Rock, he changed his mind. And instead, he called out the National Guard to, as he said, to keep the peace. But in fact, it was to keep the 9 black students there out. Up until that point, I think you could say that the mainstream media, not unlike Johnny Popham, the New York Times reporter, was having a hard time believing how extreme attitudes were. By that point, the Montgomery bus boycott had taken place and the newspapers had been slow to get down there and to really believe, no one believed that the boycotters would keep that boycott going as long as they did. So I think there was a growing respect for and belief in the tenacity of the movement that was emerging.
You came of age during the events we've been talking about, so you lived this history, and yet here you've gone back to look over it all again. Has researching and writing this book changed the way you think about the civil rights movement?
Well, that's a very good question. I can't say that it has changed what I have thought, but it has certainly given it greater depth. I grew up in Alabama. I was born in 49, so when Brown versus Board came down, I was just getting ready to enter elementary school. By the time I'm 14, I have a paper route. I live in North Alabama. I'm delivering the Birmingham News, the afternoon paper after school. And every day I'd sit there and look at the front page of the paper as I'm rolling up the papers and putting the rubber bands on it. And the Birmingham News would not have a single story on its front page about the civil rights struggle. And there in the spring of 1963, with the dogs on the loose and hoses being used on the protesters, you could not find in the Birmingham News, and I've gone back to double check, a single image in the Birmingham News or the morning paper, the Post Herald, of a dog or a hose, unless it was Pet of the Week. And they made a decision that they were going to keep the story of civil rights on pages 2 and 3, and that they were not going to put these images that were the most provocative out there. And yet my hometown paper in Florence, Alabama, was putting it out on page 1, and the national news had it every night. And, you know, this is when everyone gathered to watch national news. So there was this real disconnect that I never really was able to sort through until I began to research this and, one, find that my memory was correct, but, two, what the motives were behind it. And it wasn't just bad news judgment. It was a politicized judgment that I think had a very deleterious effect as far as informing the readers of the Birmingham papers.
Hank Klibanoff. He's the co-author, along with Gene Roberts, of The Race Beat, the press, the civil rights struggle, and the awakening of a nation. He spoke with Anne Strangchamps.